Our next presenter is Dr. Ciro Sepulveda. He chairs the History Department at Oakwood College. His doctoral degree is from the University of Notre Dame in Latin American history. He teaches in the History Department Adventist history classes. He is former president of the Association of Seventh-day Adventist Historians. And his latest publication is entitled On the Margins of the Empire of Empires, A History of Seventh-day Adventists, just published this year at Oakwood College. We're glad to invite Dr. Sepulveda to present a paper, help us to understand better. The title is The Tent and the Cathedral, White Collar Adventism and Their Search for Respectability. Welcome, Dr. Sepulveda.
The squad cars drove up to the tent on the corner of Smith and High Street, across the street from the Tijuana nightclub in Montgomery, Alabama, the summer of 1954. The officers walked through the aisles of the tent as a thousand or so African Americans listened to the evangelist Edward Earl Cleveland. Initially, few noticed. In time, however, the audience became distracted, and Cleveland calmly stated, "No need to worry. Let the officers do their jobs." Someone reported that Adventists were violating Alabama ordinances by allowing whites and blacks to commingle in public meetings. Cleveland had publicly insisted such ordinance should be disobeyed since all are the children of one God. The tent in the infested district of Montgomery received two more visitors that summer when the Reverend Ralph Abernathy, the pastor of the largest black congregation in the city, and the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. canceled their vacations because Adventists were stealing their sheep. A seamstress named Rosa Parks from the local Lutheran congregation, along with members from other denominations, attended the meetings regularly. Abernathy and King came to investigate. King told Cleveland, "I was informed that a black Billy Graham was preaching the gospel, but all I heard was the law, and the law." Cleveland, unimpressed by theological discourse, responded, "You must have arrived late, because all I was preaching was the Lord, and the Lord." For many centuries, tents like the one in Montgomery, run by Adventist itinerants, popped up all over the world. In 1854, Adventists pitched their first tent on the corner of Van Buren and Tompkins Street in Battle Creek, Michigan. When Adventists numbers grew to a few thousand, 10 years later, a dozen or so tents spread in the infested districts of the Old West. By the end of the century, tents surfaced from California to New York. When E.E. Cleveland confronted the authorities in Montgomery, Adventists had grown into hundreds of thousands, and tents continued to be centerpieces of Adventist ethos. Not all Adventists, however, felt comfortable under tents. A white-collar Adventism, more at home in cathedrals, had slowly emerged in the first half of the 20th century. Rather than working in infested districts, the new breed of Adventists felt more comfortable in suburbia. Although their parents and grandparents had come out of a traditional Adventism, they were no longer at ease with the mores of their forefathers. Some could argue that by the 1950s, an Adventist of the mind had replaced the traditional Adventism of the heart. In the first half of the 20th century, the Seventh-day Adventists experienced a series of transformations altering Adventist values, ways of looking at the world, worship styles, and agendas. In a sense, a publication of QOD in 1957 reflected the theological discourse of a group of Adventists who lived in a world different from the world of the pioneers. The traditional view of the world collapsed out of focus for the new Adventists who inherited a complex society tailoring themselves to fit. To understand the publication of QOD and the role it played in the history of the Adventist Church, it is important to recognize how Adventism changed. Why did the traditional Adventist worldview, still nurtured in most of the world, garner little respect from an emerging group of Adventists in the United States? Why was a publication of QOD necessary? Who needed to write this book? In the first half of the 20th century, two catalysts transformed Adventism. First, the new diasporas that flowed into the nation's mainstream, and second, the rise of an age of abundance. At the heart of the transformation of Adventism sat the pools from which Adventists drew their membership. Up until the 19th century, most Seventh-day Adventists came out of the Northern European diaspora. Millions of Europeans abandoned their homeland from the 17th to the 20th century and migrated north to America, South America, Africa, Australia, and other parts of the world. The first Adventist communities drew their membership from these mostly Protestant immigrants and their children. However, this pattern, which had dominated in the 19th century, came to a halt in the 20th. Between 1900 and 1910, almost 10 million immigrants entered the United States, a wave larger than any other wave in the history of the nation. Anti-Catholic and anti-Semitic prejudices reacting to the flow of mostly Catholic and Jewish immigrants grew like wildfire in American cities. Xenophobic sentiments stressing the superiority of the Northern European over Southern and Eastern Europeans took hold and inspired tens of thousands to join organizations like the Klan. By the 1920s, restrictive immigration bills sailed through Congress, fed by widespread fear of immigrants. This Southern and Eastern European wave shaped Adventism in subtle ways. For example, in 1920, the General Conference Committee received a request from the Broadview Seventh-day Adventist Seminary, an institution established in 1910 for Swedish immigrants on the outskirts of Chicago, pleading for funds to establish a foreign language department. The need came from the fact that Italian, Russian, Polish, Bohemian, Hungarian, Finnish, Romanian, Serbian, and various other Latin Slavic youths, 34 in total, had enrolled in the seminary. According to the request, their numbers could easily reach 50. The letter stated that the seminary could not accommodate the new wave of students with the current budget or curriculum. The administration of the seminary was afraid that in the coming year, 60 more would apply. The onslaught of immigrants washed over the nation at about the same time that African Americans flowed out of the South and into the industrial cities of the North. By the middle of the 20th century, millions of African Americans had migrated north. Dozens from this flow joined the Adventist Church when Adventists operated city missions. In New York, Chicago, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., black and white Seventh-day Adventists worshiped together. As the members of African Americans increased, Adventist leaders were forced to deal with a membership unlike the Protestant immigrants of the 19th century. When the General Conference moved to Washington, D.C. in the early years of the century, tension surfaced. Ill-prepared to handle the new migrants, Adventist leaders frequently mismanaged problems. Pastor Louis Schief, an African-American pastor of the Integrated Church in the city and the General Conference leadership, could not get along. In time, the tension became unbearable, forcing the People's Church to leave the Adventist fold. Another congregation in 1920, one of the largest in the South, under the leadership of Elder Mann in Savannah, Georgia, also abandoned the Adventist Church. The most dramatic rupture came in 1929 when the names of 600 members and J.K. Humphrey, the pastor of the Harlem Church, were disfellowshipped. In 1931, students at Oakwood College in Huntsville, Alabama, closed the school down, demanding that conditions change and that a black president be elected. An apparent solution to the differences between white leadership and African-American Adventists surfaced in 1944 when the General Conference segregated black Adventists by creating black conferences. Ironically, the danger older Americans feared from the new migrants and immigrants produced an era of unprecedented prosperity and growth, pushing the old stock immigrants and their children up into a middle class. Consequently, a robust white collar class enjoyed the kinds of mobility their parents had never dreamed of. The flow of new immigrants and migrants into the cities where Adventists had their churches produced an age of plenty, the likes of which the world had never seen. Wages increased dramatically. The newly generated wealth transformed the standard of living of millions of Americans, including second, third, fourth, and fifth generation Seventh-day Adventists. By 1959, Vice President Nixon could boast in the presence of the Russian leader Khrushchev that 44 million Americans owned 56 million cars, 50 million television sets, 143 million radios, and 31 million homes. The nation was indeed basking in an age of abundance. During these years, the life expectancy of an average American increased from 68 years, a 21 jump from 1900. Deadly diseases like tuberculosis, typhoid, scarlet fever, measles, and whooping cough were all but eradicated. By the time of the publication of QOD, Americans' families enjoyed shorter work weeks, paid vacations, social security, running water, central heating, electricity, refrigerators, stoves, national parks, and I Love Lucy. The economic prosperity of the nation fed and nourished the affluence of the Adventist Church, which grew its assets from $12 million in 1912 to $207 million in 1952. The growth in dollars multiplied the number of institutions and proliferated church employees. In the 19th century, most Adventist employees were pastors and Bible workers. By 1902, the church employed 2,000 workers. Two decades later, the General Conference employed 7,000 evangelistic workers and 6,000 institutional workers. The new prosperity pushed many Adventists into the middle class. In spite of the Great Depression, by 1950, 20,000 institutional workers, beneficiaries of an upward social mobility, worked for the church, 3,000 more than the traditional evangelistic worker. These changes became evident by 1929 when the General Conference established a new journal, Ministry, designed to help pastors deal with the transformations engulfing the church. The articles taught pastors how to preach, how to incorporate appropriate music into the worship service, how to pronounce words properly. Frequently in the articles of ministry, pastors were urged to rely on reasoned and rational assertions rather than emotionalism. In the October issue, S.A. Rusker suggested that new members take an oath before baptism. Clearly, the oath, like the articles in the magazine, was designed to infuse uniformity and eliminate irregularity brought into the church by immigrants and migrants. Rusker provided a list of 9 beliefs that, in his opinion, new Adventists needed to embrace. Up until the publication of this list, Adventists did not have a uniform set of doctrines. In a statement the church published in 1872 called Fundamental Principles of the Seventh-day Adventist, the following sentence appeared: Seventh-day Adventists have no creed but the Bible. During the 19th century, Adventists commonly held divergent interpretations of the Bible. The following quote of John Loughborough illustrates how Adventists disliked the idea of adopting a set uniform doctrine. The first step of apostasy is to set up a creed, telling us what we shall believe. The second is to make that creed a test of fellowship. The third is to try members by that creed. The fourth is to denounce as heretics those who do not believe in that creed. And fifth, to commence persecution against such. In the 19th century, theological discourse was not given much weight by the members of the Adventist Church. The fact that several of the leaders of the church did not believe in the Trinity illustrates. The urgent desire to tell others of the second coming of Jesus forced Adventists to resist the creation of a creed for many decades. As late as 1919, Adventists held healthy debates on the nature of Christ and the Trinity without anyone demanding punishment for whoever did not hold a particular opinion. By the 1930s, however, under the avalanche of new members and upwardly mobile membership, the idea of an oath appeared to have struck a unifying chord in the readership of ministry. In the issues following the first, other pastors offered better and improved lists. Under the editorial leadership of A.J. Daniels and his protege, Leroy Froom, there developed a desire to create a set standard that Adventists would uphold. In 1931, the president of the General Conference, Elder C. Watson, created a committee of 4 which authored a statement of beliefs. However, Watson, fearing opposition, never submitted the new document to the body of the church for a vote. The statement simply appeared in print for the first time in 1931 yearbook. The new ethos became even more apparent as abundance spread across the landscape. The Protestant ethic of self-denial rooted in scarcity, which shaped the Adventist pioneer culture, came under inspection. By the middle of the 20th century, as Americans began to place greater value on self-expression and satisfying lives, the ethic was no longer functional for some white-collar Adventists. Leisure time, something the pioneers rarely savored, became a staple of the new society as many Americans began to discard the ascetic traditions of the past. If E.E. Cleveland in Montgomery, Alabama in the 1950s exemplified the old-time Adventist ethos, Leroy Froom in Washington, D.C. epitomized the emerging white-collar Adventism. Froom came from a third-generation Adventist family, son of an Adventist medical doctor who headed the General Conference Health Department at the beginning of the century. As editor of ministry, professor at the Adventist Theological Seminary, and field secretary of the General Conference, Froom wrote extensively, helping shape the emerging Adventism. Froom's profound desire to mainstream Adventism made him ill at ease with the old Adventism. He wanted to take Adventists from the rank of an apocalyptic sect to the status of a denomination, uneasy with the label cult usually applied to Seventh-day Adventists in his day. In his younger years as editor of The Watchman, he had always wanted to reach the educated and upper class. Apparently tired of immigrants and migrants, he wanted lawyers, magistrates, legislators, and editors to embrace Adventist teachings. Wanting the world to understand that Seventh-day Adventists were genuine Protestants. In an article in the Review and Herald, he wrote, "Seventh-day Adventists are the preeminent Protestants today." Convinced that the Adventists were the true inheritors of the teachings of the early church and the Protestant Reformation, Froome believed that through scholarly research and reasoned argument, Adventists would become, quote unquote, respectable. To prove so, he spent countless hours in the most prominent archives in the United States and made two trips to Europe to visit the libraries of Oxford, Cambridge, and the British Museum. Unlike E.E. Cleveland, who distrusted civil and religious authorities, L.E. Froome saw himself as a Protestant conservative scholar chosen by God to write a distinctive Adventist theology. He clearly wanted his church to be an integrated part of the larger society. In a paper Froome read for the 1952 SDA Bible Conference, he used the metaphor of a great cathedral. In his opinion, the Seventh-day Adventists were called to finish the construction of a cathedral being built across the ages by the chosen. The task of the new Adventism was to provide for the world a correct and enlightened theology. Froome's agenda and priorities reflected his personal position and also the changes taking place in the church. In 1932, the Autumn Council of the General Conference voted to establish a school of theology. When they discovered that such a project was too ambitious, they started the Advanced Bible School in the summer of 1934 with its first session on the campus of Pacific Union College. Although the church did not have trained theologians, it took its most respected leaders and turned them into theology professors. The president of Union College, M.L. Andreessen, became professor of systematic theology. William M. Landine, president of Walla Walla College, became professor of church history. Leroy Froome, professor of ministry and early Advent sources. Benjamin P. Hoffman became the dean of the school and professor of prophecy and world religion. By 1942, the Seventh-day Adventist Seminary was granting a master's degree, and 3 years later, by 1945, its first Bachelor of Divinity. In 1953, the General Conference voted that all ministerial students who graduated from one of the Adventist colleges do a fifth year in the seminary. Joining the Protestant mainstream had become a priority for the new Adventism, and the best way to achieve that end was to produce better trained clergy who could articulate a reasoned theology. The need to defend rationally the teachings of the Adventist Church and make the church respectable also produced a multi-volume commentary, the Seventh-day Adventist Bible Commentary. I'm skipping to the next paragraph. By 1950, the new Adventist ethos was in full bloom, and the transformation of Adventist culture could be seen everywhere. Adventist sanitariums became Adventist hospitals. Adventist training schools turned into liberal arts colleges. Tents in infested districts disappeared, and Adventist cathedrals like the one in Tacoma Park, Maryland, became the new model for Adventist houses of worship. City missions gave way to disaster relief. Professionally trained clergy replaced itinerant preachers. Adventist campgrounds morphed into Adventist retreats. Testimony-filled sermons developed into theological discourses. And pipe organ-accompanied anthems replaced syncopated gospel songs in storefront churches. In summary, the first half of the 20th century witnessed the rise of a white-collar Adventism that shed many of its traditional standards and replaced them with a new agenda. Questions on Doctrines reflects the struggle of the new Adventism and how they tried to figure out the nature of Christianity. Reacting to the new waves of immigrants and migrants which poured into the United States, the leadership of the church adapted, modified, and transformed. The age of abundance helped the church develop new tastes and desires. Leisure time allowed white-collar Adventists to reflect upon their teachings, values, and how they fit into the larger society, creating in the process a crop of Adventist theologians and theologies. Ironically, in an effort to be true to their calling, the white-collar Adventists also appear to have undermined the growth and expansion of Adventism. By the 1950s, the new Adventism walked on a path many radical Christian communities had journeyed in the past. The pattern was familiar. A radical sect, distrustful of civic and religious authorities, grows like wildfire, challenging the values and standards of those in power. As a sect prospers and begins to savor the fruits of success, its distaste for the ways of the culture diminish. With the passage of time, the religion of the sect conforms and learns to adapt, becoming not much different than the religion of the empire.